Call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let's let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, the February 13th. We have a quorum to do business. Present are Senator Bishop, Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairman Birch. Vice Chair Coghill is excused, and Senator Giesel will be joining us shortly. I also wanted to open this meeting up by noting that Alaska elder statesman and interior icon Jack Coghill, 93, died Wednesday morning in North Pole. Coghill's death was reported by the troopers at 9 a.m. Cause of death not noted. Coghill grew up in a working family mercantile in Nenana with his brothers and served in the First Territorial House of Representatives in 1953. Coghill served a tour of duty during World War II and was one of two surviving delegates with Vic Fisher to the Alaska Constitutional Convention. He is the third signature in the document, according to a profile by KUAC Radio in Fairbanks. He also served as a senator in the first three state legislatures. It was known as Mr. Republican in a body then dominated by Democrats. Coghill was a mayor of Nenana for more than two decades. He was elected lieutenant governor under the late Waldy Hickel on the Alaska Independence Party in 1990 and served until 1994. His son, John, our vice chair here, is a state senator who served as a majority leader 4 years and now chairs the Senate Rules Committee. John is traveling home to, Senator Coghill is traveling home to Fairbanks from Juneau this afternoon and is unable to be here. John was also got a great quote I wanted to read. This is from Jack's son, John, our colleague. Dad was a firm believer in utilizing Alaska's natural resources to build a strong economy and provide good-paying jobs for Alaska. He had the same passion for Alaska, even at age 93. I know I personally will treasure my copy of the Alaska Constitution, actually signed by Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill. I just would extend our deepest thoughts and prayers for our colleague John Coghill and his family on the passage of his father. With that, thank you for your thank you. And I see Senator Giesel has joined us. And with that, we will see if we have any other legislators in the office. In the room here, I see none. I'd remind you to turn your cell phones off if you haven't, or at least put them on silent. And let's see, we have one item on today's agenda. It's an overview and an update on the Ambler Access Project. Leading the presentation today will be Mark Davis, ADA Chief Infrastructure Development Officer, and Jeff San Juan, ADA Infrastructure Development Senior Finance Officer. And I just want to take an opportunity to thank you both for being here. We are trying to fill the time in this early part of the legislature with our confirmation hearings and then presentations on industry and aspects of our state economy that are so vital to our future and in fact being open for business. And you know, ADA and your operation are key to that. I would note for the record that we have been joined by Senator Kawasaki as well. With that, you have the table, and please proceed.
Mr. Chair, it's Mark Davis for the record. So I was going to have Mr. San Juan start off to give you kind of overview of the project. And then I'm going to go through some of the permitting process and where we are with the NEPA process, which is somewhat legal.
Great. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff San Juan, the project manager for the Ambler Mining District Industrial Access Project, also known as AMDAP, or for this presentation, I'll refer to it as simply the project. As Mark mentioned, he's a Chief Infrastructure Development Officer for ADA, and the topics we would like to discuss this afternoon are ADA's role and why we are actively engaged in the project, the DeLong Mountain Transportation System model, which ADA would like to duplicate with the project, provide the committee the project background, purpose, and project specifics, and we will then, as Mark mentioned, discuss the permitting status and next steps. So ADA's role. By statute, ADA was created with the foresight to develop the state's natural resources, which in turn would provide long-term economic growth for the state and will directly and indirectly help alleviate unemployment. ADA has been given certain tools and resources to be able to accomplish its mission. With those tools, ADA has been able to develop several projects in the state on this map by either owning the project or financing them. In the Northwest Arctic Borough, one of the things we're going to highlight is the success of the DMTS. And that's where we're going to talk about the DMTS. The DMTS is considered to be one of the state of Alaska's success stories, providing over 500 direct jobs at the mine site and at least 500 equivalent indirect jobs outside of the mine site. Revenues to the Northwest Arctic Borough in the form of a payment in lieu of taxes between $14 million and $18 million annually, and in lieu for 2018 are a village improvement fund, which ranges between $4 to $8 million annually. Revenues to the Native Regional Corporation of NANA, and which are then shared via 7I and 7J payments with other Native Regional Corporations, are a success. And the Red Dog model is, you know, this image is kind of the stakeholders in the region. The Red Dog model was a very complex project that involved many stakeholders and agreements to make the project a success as it is today. The circles in this image represent all the many stakeholders, and the lines and the arrows are the many forms of agreements and sources of revenues that basically go through to each of those stakeholders. But it took a lot of effort and a lot of manpower to make this project a success. The project background. This is courtesy of NANA, but on the left side is an image from 1968 that highlights one of the prospects in the Ambler Mining District, which is still known as the Bornite Deposit. It's on the left side here. And then the right side, we have in 1981 some of the potential routes that was set up after the passage of ANILCA. So it's just incredible to see how fast they got to work to try to figure out all the routes that they could potentially access the mining district. So our leaders in Congress, as they passed ANILCA, really understood the potential for this mining district. They wanted to unlock the state's natural resources by adding this provision in ANILCA. And I'll read. In ANILCA Section 201.4b, it states, Congress finds that there is a need for access for surface transportation purposes across the Reston Kobuk River, unit of the Gates of the Arctic National Preserve, from the Ambler Mining District to the Alaska Pipeline Haul Road. And the Secretary shall permit such access in accordance with this provision of this subsection. So Congress really understood the importance of this mining district, that they put it in law. So the project's purpose. The project's purpose is really to unlock the resource-rich region that exists, 75 miles of mineralization area, full of copper, zinc, lead, gold, silver, and cobalt resources. And the resource estimates just between Arctic and Bornite, two of the mineral resources in that 75-mile area that have been explored by Trilogy, have uncovered 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, and over 1 million ounces of gold equivalent in precious metals. And that's strictly from the uncovering of Trilogy Metals, which they're in the, I believe Rick is in the crowd today. All right. So the goals of the project is to provide access to unlock the Ambler Mining District natural resources, to further support exploration and development, to promote economic development and job opportunities for the region and for the state. So So ADA took over the project in 2013 from DOTPF. And they once we took over the preferred, once we took over the project, ADA looked through all the different alternatives and selected the best route that would be less impactful to the environment. And we also avoided communities that did not want our road to go through their communities. So we were able to move the route at least the eastern 50 miles away from Bettles because they were not in support of having a road directly through their community.
And so that leads to the next step, which is permitting the project. Essentially, under NEPA, you have to do an environment impact statement, and that's really like a building permit today. If you don't have an EIS, you're not going to build the road, particularly across wetlands. It also triggers 404B of the Clean Water Act, which brings in the Corps of Engineers. And their job is to make sure that the route picked is the least destructive and environmentally positive. There's tests. And then finally, as we've described, this is mentioned in the Alaska Interest National Lands Act, or NILCA, for our right to cross the preserve. So you've got an interplay between NEPA, Clean Water Act, and NILCA, which meant to file for this permit, we actually had to file under NILCA. And then that triggered a federal action, and then we got the BLM engaged, and then we started to spend money. The way you draft an EIS is you hire a third-party contractor, and that's done with permission of the federal government. Here, with a competitive bid, we selected HDR Incorporated, and they're now in the process of drafting the EIS. So as you can see from this slide, we've got four major federal agencies involved. And that's just for the permitting under the EIS. If the project goes forward, if you get an EIS, there'll be permitting from the state, from local government, from a lot of other entities. But this is just the first step, and that's where we're at, is developing this EIS. Okay. So just to go through that real quick, you file a notice of intent, and that got done with the federal government. There were some delays from BLM, and we had to negotiate agreements with them. It took us 8 months to draft agreements, but we finally got it done. After that, we started to roll a lot quicker. They filed the notice in February of 2017, and the next step is scoping. Those are public meetings to go out and ask people what they think of the project. You may have seen the publicity about the scoping meetings for ANWR recently. We went through similar meetings. Ours were less noisy. I think we had a better dialogue going on, but we had lots of them. We've been to many, many communities, small communities, big communities. We did to pick up other communities farther away. We decided to do telephonic. And so we phoned into city clerks, and we posted things in post offices. People dialed in. They actually did, you know, in the smaller villages. And we heard from everybody. As Jeff said, some of the comments were move the road. And ADA does not have the right of eminent domain like DOT. So we shifted the road to accommodate land owners or to comments. So we're not stuck on that. And that scoping process was finished in February of 2018, and a scoping report done in April. Now the next step is alternatives. If you go back to that slide with all the routes.
Oh, yeah.
The DOT did.
DOT?
In an EIS for a road, it's a little complicated because if you're doing a mine development, you're looking at alternatives to the way that you might operate the mine. But when you're building a road, the alternatives are, can you build the road somewhere else? Or the no-build option. So BLM engaged in a process of looking at all the data that DOT had done. We provided it to them. DOT was very cooperative. They flew up to Fairbanks to meet with BLM and spent several days with them. So I want to thank the department for doing that. And then the BLM thought they had an alternative. And we met with them. It had, in my view, a legal flaw. We met with the solicitor, who was the main lawyer for the Department of Interior. We negotiated over that. And just 15 minutes ago, BLM has provided us with what they now view the appropriate alternative. And that will then trigger HDR as the contractor to analyze those alternatives, to look at which one's the best route. Is our route, that one over the top, the best route, or is it better to go in some other direction? Always remembering that Congress has stated that the federal government should provide the state of Alaska with access to this mining district. Yeah, and then you can see on the slide, we've got our preferred route there blown up, but there could be other routes. Basically, what we wanted to do was use the existing infrastructure of the Dalton Highway, because we have it, so that the trucks would go from the district on a controlled manner, like on the DMTS, the Dalton Mountain Transportation System. That control is necessary for watching out for wildlife, for making sure you have dust control, a lot of reasons that make it safe. For example, on the DMTS, if they spot caribou, they stop. And a couple years ago, our chairman, Mr. Pruse, was up there, and he got to spend a couple hours by the side of the road while the caribou passed, because that's just, it applies to everybody. So that's what route, let me go back to the slides we have.
Yep.
Okay.
You want to go over any of these?
Well, no, next one on this, we go up to the construction.
Okay.
Because we didn't cover that.
Yep.
One thing we want to talk about is phased development. Jumping around a little bit, but we've decided to try to do a phase one, which is a narrow 16-foot road, be relatively inexpensive, about $280 to $300 million. That would let other mines, there's some other deposits in this area, explore those deposits with less money. And if you talk to Trilogy or NANA, it's very expensive using helicopters and flying in, so that would encourage further development. But the mine could also use it to get the first production out, which also then cash flow the project. Once it cash flows, go to phase two, which is an 18-foot single lane. And then eventually, if there's enough demand, if you open up a 4 to 5 mines, you might go to a two-lane. But that would be based upon the needs. We've sought permitting for a two-lane road just to be safe with the federal government, but it'll be built the way it works best for the project. The DMTS is run as a single-lane road. It's really a little wider. But if you've seen the pictures of the DMTS, the trucks are driving right down the middle. That's what's safe, that's what's best for the wildlife, and that's what we do. So if you see, go back to that little slide I had, you know, we're now at the alternatives, that should get going. Next would be existing conditions, impact analysis under environmental law. Then mitigation, that's a statement where the federal government may ask for mitigation issues to buy other land to set it aside if you're filling in wetlands, or to mitigate wildlife impacts. They'll have controls. Then they'll draft the EIS. They go out for public comment again. That's what I want to emphasize. People are saying, what's this process? Are they going to participate? They are. This thing will be drafted with a lot of science, a lot of engineering, and then it goes out again in the Federal Register. They have more meetings. The public has to comment again. It's not in concrete. And then they draft the final EIS, and then they still have a record of decision, and you can still comment on that before this record of decision. So it's a lengthy process. So the timeline we've got signed as of December of 18 is the draft EIS in August, the final EIS in November, and a record of decision in December 2019. Now, we could not foresee when we signed that document that a few weeks later the federal government would shut down. And our friends at BLM were furloughed, as happened. So we've lost some time, and we're not being critical. But they say they're trying to catch it up, and we can accelerate it back by just paying the contract from HGR to just spend more time, just put more resources, because they're private. And so that we're in negotiations now to do that and to get the thing back on track. So essentially, that's what it is trying to do, is to try to replicate the DMTS. It's longer, of course. But the DMTS was needed because that mine couldn't operate unless it had some way to get that ore to market. Here, without access, the ore is very hard to get to market. So if you use the route to the Dalton, then you can hook up to the railroad, or you can truck it all the way down. Depends on what the mines decide to do. Again, ADA won't make that decision. We get asked these questions, and we're only trying to build that industrial access corridor, and then the private sector takes over. We won't dictate, we won't tell them how they're going to run their mine or how they're going to run their ore. How do we get paid back? We get paid back like we did at Red Dog. If we float bonds, there'll be tolls or payments on the road, and those payments will, over time, will reduce that debt, and then the life of the road should be in excess of the bonded indebtedness. And that's the same as with Red Dog. So the Red Dog bonds, you know, may expire, but I think the Red DMTS will be used after the bonds are paid off. That's the way it looks now. and I think that'll be the case here, because these roads go for quite some time. This is an important mining district. It has a lot of good mineralization. The other thing is asked, are these mines going to open? Are they viable? You got Trilogy working very hard on it, very good company, first-rate operation. We've got South 32, an investor from Australia, now working with NANA and with Trilogy. And then there will probably be other investors coming in. So there's real interest in this, and it's moving along. So in that sense, we think it can be a longer, bigger DMTS, but the same type of project. And again, ADA won't operate a mine. It won't invest in a mine. We're just providing the infrastructure. And even that infrastructure eventually could even be sold off by the state in the future if that's the decision that the government should make. And that's our presentation. We thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Mark and Jeff, for a great presentation. Before we get to committee questions, I just wanted to also note that if there are any questions that may be more appropriate for the mining project developer to respond to, Rick Van Nieuwenhuis, CEO of Trilogy Metals, is in the audience here. So with that, questions? Senator Reinbold?
Thank you, Chair Birch. So this was a fascinating presentation. You guys went really, really fast, so I may have missed this, okay? Because I was just really trying to keep up with you guys. But on slide number 19, this is the proposed construction costs. I just want you to drill down a little bit. On phase one, it was 16 feet for a 16-foot single-lane seasonal road for $280 million, and then you went to phase two, 18 foot for $40 million additional, and then the 32-foot year-round, an additional $60 million for a total of $380 million. It just, the math doesn't seem exactly right. I mean, you know, for like a 16-foot is $280, but then an 18-foot is $40 million.
Right.
If you could just get into the math a little bit for me.
Again, so Senator Rebel, through the chair, it's a great question. These, by the way, these are figures done as of November of 17, so that we haven't updated them from places since then, but they're fairly recent. They were done by Dow, who, a contractor, probably well-known in the state, often does work for DOT and is our project manager for ADA on this. They're phased in. So it's 280, you know, for the first one, then an additional $40 million because you've already got it in. So the next part of the road costs a lot less because the big part is getting the gravel in and getting the road bed down. And a slight expansion doesn't cost much. You can see, though, that moving to a two-lane costs a lot more, and that's that affects the apron of the road. You've got to put a lot more gravel down, and that we're assuming here too that we've got one lane bridges, you know, all the way across.
Right.
Because two lane bridges were very expensive. In talking to Tech and our experience in running the DMTS, these are controlled roads with limits on how they're used. We'll be able to. They use radios at Tech. And we'll have radio towers in, but we think we'll also have fiber optic. We've asked BLM for right-of-way for fiber optic, and that way we'll let them really control the trucks. Each truck will have a GPS probably in it. We'll know exactly where it is, and you can follow it down the road. So, that's a great question because the first phase is a lot of money. The second phase isn't much. And then, Senator, the next phase is quite a bit more. And that's why that'll be a decision made phase three with the mines. You know, do they need that much more, or do we want to have a less expensive piece of infrastructure?
Hello?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so I get it. You know, it's 16 foot and it's a seasonal road, but phase two is the year round. So obviously they're beefing it up and widening it just a little bit. And then phase three, you know, it's a full blown 32 foot. And I apologize if I missed this. I really was trying to follow you guys. But is there any ask in the budget? Did you guys mention that? Or is it all ADA funded?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, is another good question. The reason, and I was part of the group that asked for this to be moved from DOT to ADA, was I foresaw in 2013 that the state was not going to have the same kind of money it's had in the future. And at least that was my viewpoint back then, and, you know, we've had some issues. And also, I think the DMTS was done without GF and our new executive director Tom Batan, you may not know, was actively involved in the Red Dog bond structure. So we would not need any more money from the state coffer. This is designed to be probably a public-private partnership. There'd be probably some ADA bonds, but there's also infrastructure funds that like to invest in these kind of projects. because they have a long-term payout, and they have a steady payout. So also, all of the EIS is paid for. We just confirmed that last week with BLM. They don't need any further funds, and HDR says they don't need any further funds. So we are all in.
Thank you. Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could you talk a bit more about the DMTS as a successful project?
Sure.
Have the bonds been paid back? Is there a toll still being paid? All of that. Why is it a successful model?
Senator Giesel, it's a great question. You're asking for, we gave you the success about what it's done for the region, but the success for ADA as the finance entity is another story. The bonds were issued, they were backed up by legislative appropriation back then, so that it wasn't, that's really how ADA started, beyond doing simple loans. Was it the first thing it ever did as a big project was this DMTS. And it took that money from the legislature, it turned them into bonds, sold the bonds to the private market, right? And then it paid for the bond debt for a while before the mine made money, and then Tech has been paying. Tech has been paying like clockwork, and the bonds will be paid for in a couple of years. The mine recently is looking to expand the road and the port. The good news is Tech probably will not approach ADA for that. That is, once ADA can do a successful project, then the next phase of a good project is also done just by private capital. You know, they don't come back to us. They've got their track record. They can show what they're making. They just go out in the market and get capital.
And through the chair, Senator Giesel, to answer your question, you know, part of the pieces that we have outstanding for bond is we do have bonds that are tentatively set to be paid off by 2023. We have an agreement with Tech into 2040 is when our agreement with them. And if you look at this slide, which is slide 8, it kind of talks about several different, especially between Red Dog, Tech in the middle, and ADA, which is on the left-hand corner. There's these different types of agreements, MMAs, CEZs, that really help accelerate the payments of those notes. So the model with DMTS is a success because if the commodity prices go up over a certain dollar amount, ADA gets additional funds. If the load, if the amount of shipping they ship out goes up above a certain amount, ADA receives additional funds. So as we've received additional funds for those from the success of Red Dog over the past couple of years of shipping over 1 billion zinc concentrates, the price of zinc commodity going up higher, ADA has been getting additional funds every year to pay down that debt.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today. I'm pleased to hear the update. I hadn't heard about what's been going on for a while on this particular project. I had a handful of questions. First is the public law 96487 that you talked about, and it does talk about an access point between the pipeline haul road to the district. And other than that, is there any other designation of what that, you know, is it a trail, is it a road? You mentioned that you're talking about now a two-lane road in the third phase.
Senator Kavanaugh, the chair. Yeah, that's a good question because Congress sometimes writes things rather obliquely. we pulled out the committee record for this particular document, and it shows that when they meant service transportation, they meant an intermodal transportation system, i.e., a road. That was the discussion at the committee from the Amber Money District to what was then called the Hall Road, now the Dalton. And so there actually is congressional committee record on that.
Great. Follow-up? And there was talk years before the DOT project that talked about using the Western route. Can you talk a little bit about why the Western route wasn't chosen or wasn't selected?
Well, because I just got the alternatives from BLM, I'm not going to prejudge them. I don't know what they selected, but if you look at this chart, The DOT did look at Western routes, and they determined that they were not as good environmentally or economically as going the other way. But that doesn't mean BLM may not analyze the Western route. I don't want to. They choose the alternatives. That's what they do. The one thing is, if you go from the west, you're going to tend to cross conservation units under NOCA, which are, in one case, a national park, and another is a national preserve. And there's no congressional authority to cross those. Now, under Title 11 of NOCA, there is a provision that you can cross conservation units, but it's never been done. The Eisenbeck Road is an example of an attempt to use that authority, but so far it hasn't been built. And so I think that's one consideration, although it's out there. And then also there's more wetlands to the west. And then what Congress wanted was to tie it up to – that's what your question about the history is a really good one. They wanted to tie it up to an existing intermodal system so that the idea was this road would hook into whatever we had out there. And to the west, we don't really have a fully developed port, which would mean that you'd have to build a port. But, again, it's entirely possible that when I get back, the office can open up what I just got. They'll have a western route.
Mr. Sandlin, you had to follow up? Sorry, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I just want to add to that is part of the purpose and need that BLM has is that, as Mark mentioned, that it's year-round access. And so part of the reason they're selecting the alternative routes, it has to be through year-round access. And so I'm not anticipating seeing any kind of western routes being proposed as an alternative due to the fact, as Mark mentioned, there's not a year-round access on the western side as it exists right now.
Questions?
I have more questions, but I don't want to hog the. A couple questions just about the public financing, and Mark, I think, did a good job of sort of identifying how we recoup money back. Can you tell me? Do you ever check and verify the creditworthiness of the company that's engaged in the prospect?
Kawasaki, through the chair, we read the reports that, for example, Trilogy puts out, more than just their PEA, we follow them quarterly, and what they're doing, just because we're looking at them. We've met with South 32, the other investors in Alaska, several times, and we've done some due diligence on South 32's capabilities. And then our other potential partner here is NANA, which owns the Bornite. We have complete confidence in NANA. Obviously, we work with NANA on the Red Dog matter.
Thank you. I believe you have another question from Senator Giesel.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just looking. I don't see that you have the DMTS. Oh, you do? Do I see a DMTS map here? I don't think you included one.
No.
So, gentlemen, several members of the committee are kind of new to the resources topic, and they may not know that Red Dog, while they drive the concentrate on trucks down to the port, they actually have a seasonal port there. Talk about the storage facility, which is quite phenomenal, right, which they use during the winter.
Sure. Senator Giesel, the chair, excellent point. And we didn't bring our we have a whole presentation on DMTS. Somebody wants one. We're proud of it. But we just got a call from the government of Canada that noted that we had done DMTS and a model like that. And so other people are looking at it, by the way. So it's a you have to lighter the ore. The ships can't come in, and they can't come in year round. And that was a major issue. So. The port consists not only of a conveyor belt to load the ships, which would be a typical situation. It also has a storage unit. They're gigantic buildings. If you've seen pictures of them, they're red. They're painted with an American flag. They're so large that during one of the space walks, one of the astronauts asked Houston what was that large building in northern Alaska. That's actually true. They're big. You can see them from space. That was a way to get around the engineering problem of the seasonal port, and we financed that whole issue. But the new expansion of the port, which Tech is now undertaking, the point I wanted to make is they're not approaching ADA, which is fine. They're going to, you know, finance it themselves. So sometimes we've had this happen a couple of times when we've been able to do a successful project. The next step is done without ADA.
No, I had another question, follow-up. Thank you. So thank you for highlighting that. So the idea of a western route actually doesn't provide year-round access. And I wanted to illustrate that so that folks that maybe have never seen Red Dog would understand. I'm also looking at page 18 as far as the routes and why, again, the western route. You highlighted that there are, to the west, more preserves, et cetera. Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, but the Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve is that lavender color on slide 18. And it extends down in what is called a boot. Okay, it's often referred to as a boot. And did Congress not provide for transverse of that boot? Could you elaborate on that?
Senator Keats, for the chair. Yeah, the portion we read, a part of Vanilka, and there's another portion, provide that the boot will remain National Park Service land. But the National Park Service must provide access to the state of Alaska across the preserve. And it provides for a unique process. It's an environmental and economic assessment that is not NEPA. It says right in the statute, I don't think we'll see this again. We must thank Senator Stevens. And it says it will be a non-NEPA process that will be carried out by the Secretaries of Transportation and Interior, and they will select the route. So we have contracted with the National Park Service for the preparation of this EEA, and again, they've hired a third-party contractor, which is different than HDR, but they've hired their own contractor. We have paid that contractor. And right now, the Park Service is working on two possible routes. And if you look at this chart we have the bright yellow, which is our preferred route. But the National Park Service, you can see it's a little darker. They asked us to develop what they call the southern route because they thought that would be farther away from a particular lake that has some values. So we had Dow engineer a second southern route. And the Secretaries of Transportation and Interior will pick that route across the so-called boot. And we were told that that was going to be done by May. Of course, again, we've lost some time because all the National Park Service people that worked on this were furloughed. But they're back at work, and the contractor has been paid.
Hello?
I just have one last comment, and it pertains to the economic evaluation that you said the federal government is requiring. I want to highlight that Alaska led the way on health assessment impact evaluations for any of our resource development on state lands, and we were the first state to implement that. So robust permitting process.
I want to tell you that we have a health assessment contractor retained. And they're working with the BLM, and that is consistent with our state law, which caused some of the interior people, remember, to ask what we were doing. But so, yeah, we are more strict, and that's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe back up just a step, a little bit of history on the DeLong Mountain project, You developed that with internal ADA funds or state general funds, or was there an agreement for repayment backed by the mine company at that point?
Feel free to share. That's a good question because there was an appropriation. The legislature gave ADA the money because ADA at that time basically just did small loans to banks, and then it turned went out to the bond market. It went out and got bonds based on that appropriation. And then Tech actually was far along, so it's a little different. They already had the mine permitted and were pretty much ready to go. What they did is, I understand it, and Mr. Bedeen would know more than I do, they ran out of funding, and they approached ADA and the legislature as a way to get that gap capital, which is one thing ADA does, kind of when you can't find anybody else, but it still makes sense to do it. And so we funded the road and the port, and then they agreed to pay through all those agreements that we've got. And they have acceleration clauses, and they have sideboards to make them safe. So eventually, ADA has paid back that entire appropriation from a dividend we pay every year, So that all the original appropriation that Ada got has been paid back to the legislature. But it was an appropriated fund, and it was a risk at the time, because here, you know, the risk is, can you bond it and get paid back by multiple companies, or are they going to stay in business? There, Teck was willing to pay, and it's a big company, but you had a single commodity, zinc, you had a single mine, and you had a really unique lightering storage system, which was expensive, but it all worked. So it was a kind of a mixed project at that time.
Follow up. So then for this project, the funding, I don't know how much you're spending on the EIS. You said you've got the funding to complete it. But how far are we in, and what's the funding source now?
So, I don't know how much DOT spent before we took it over. I'm not privy to that. We have spent, and it's on our website, we have spent $17 million to date, and that includes the cost through the ROD. That is, it should be all the costs. We just confirmed that with BLM, that they don't need any further funds. We're funding BLM. And then confirmed with HDR, they don't need further funds. So we think, but we have some in reserve, that was appropriated funds. That is rare. Ada rarely has appropriated funds. And that was an idea that came when we transferred it from DOT to Ada, that they had an appropriation, and we'd take over the rest of the appropriation, and then we got another appropriation. Ada has the legal authority now. Our statutes have been changed so that we could have self-funded a permit process like this, and in the future that may be the decision of the Ada board. I would leave that to the Ada board. That's not what I do.
One more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, at this point, if I understand, we don't have agreements with potential mine operators for repayment or road tariff or.
Right. So, Chair, we're doing the EIS. If we get an EIS that's favorable, we get a route that we like, then we are in the process of developing a finance plan. That's required by ADA statutes of how we would finance this project. Once we get a finance plan in place, then we'll go see the mining companies that want to open these mines, and then we'll start to draft agreements for them. And if we can't come to an agreement, then we won't build the road.
Mr. San Juan,
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we do have resolutions from the Northwest Arctic Borough and the North Slope Borough interested in investing in this project, and so they have sent a resolution passed sometime last year, late fall, that says we would like to be investors. And they've recently approached us within the last months, saying we need to start opening up dialogue because we would like to be investors in this project, and even considering in the early stage, so after the EIS process, or, you know, so they're really approaching us. So we do have potential investors who are interested in that are not private entities but government entities.
Senator Rainbold.
Thank you, Chair Birch. Okay, so just a quick comment, because it's this discussion as well. I have gone on your amblereaccess.org and your amblereaccess.com, and just for the listeners on Gavel to Gavel or whoever, a lot of this presentation is right there on both of those websites, including your newsletter. So anyway, I was pretty impressed with that. But I have two questions for you. One is, has this ever been part of the Roads to Resources? Of course, me and probably most of us here are for responsible resource development. I want to know if that strategy is still in place, or is this part of something that so Alaskans can connect to the project, if it's part of Roads to Resources. And then my second question would be, is there any major pushback that we need to be aware of? Because I think everybody in Alaska is looking for job opportunities and economic growth and diversification, and this would not only be capital infrastructure, but then there's a lot of jobs on the other end of the road. So thank you.
Senator Rainbold, yeah, those were good questions. And so I think – help me with the history there.
So, Senator Chair, Senator Rainbold, I think for the first question, which I want to restate, is it's really trying to figure out if – actually, the second question was, is there any opposition. So let me start with that one first. As you look at this slide 18 – one thing, I don't have the distinction here, but right in the middle of the boot is you have the Northwest Arctic Borough and Nanalands on the west side, and then on the east side, you have the Doyon lands and unincorporated boroughs. And one of the challenges for our project, as far as opposition goes, is that most of the mineral resources that have, you know, that are known and recognized are in the Northwest Arctic Borough, Nana region. And so our route goes from west, east to west, crossing, you know, Doyon lands and Doyon region lands and unincorporated lands, non-borough lands. And so what we've heard from the communities in those villages and area is that we get all the impacts and we don't get any benefits. So that's some of the pushback that we're hearing from the eastern portion of the road. A lot of the communities on the western side understand the benefits of having a mining district because they have the experience with the DMTS and the Red Dock. So they're starting to see improvements in their villages, improvements in their borough, and jobs. And so we're trying to really be able to provide some benefits. And from my understanding, and I'll leave it up to Rick to discuss, is that there's some type of agreements being in place that allows Trilogy to start working with the communities in the Doyon region to provide jobs. And so I'm not quite certain of that, but that's what I've heard. And then as to the first question,
I was thinking about how to answer that. It's a little complicated. Governor Murkowski had a general idea of roads to resources. It wasn't really defined, so I don't want to overstate it. Definitely DOT started to look at some of those roads, and one was the Umiat Road, and one was this road. And they did some work on this, but their issue was how could they fund the road? And then how could they get an EIS? Because they face some difficulties. So ADA took it over, but we didn't really take it over as a roads to resources project. I don't want to overstate it, but it did start out that way.
Follow up? Okay, so I guess it sounds like there's pushback possibly from Doyon, if I'm reading into this correctly. But when I look on your website, it clearly defines ANILCA, you know, establishing, 10 federal parks, preserves, monuments, etc., but guaranteeing certain rights of access for subsistence, hunting, fishing, recreational, and other economic and social purposes, including ensuring access to resource development areas within the state. So is that a powerful, do you think you're going to be able to overcome the objection of Doyon and possibly others, is my question.
So, member through the chair, I'd be hopeful that we could come to a project that would satisfy the stakeholders in the area. There's a lot of interest in jobs. There's also an interest in preserving subsistence hunting. On the DMTS, we have a really good record with the caribou mortality. Very few caribou have been killed by trucks on that road, and when they do, they write up a full report. I mean, it's a big deal. We have with the new fiber optic, we'll be able to monitor that even better than that road. So we're very sensitive to preserving those subsistence rights, and we're very hopeful that we can get local hire. We can provide anybody in that area a job. And additionally, people, of course, in other communities, Fairbanks and Anchorage. So the first process is to see if we can get the EIS, and then, you know, you'd work with the mines, the agreements I talked about. But another portion of your agreements is going to be agreements with the community on how to facilitate, not implement, but facilitate that local hire and that community input. And the Pogo Mine Road stands as an example because that road was built privately by Sumitomo. It's 52 miles long. Originally, it was meant to be taken out entirely. And during comments on that road, the community asked if the first 26 miles could remain in place after the mine stops, and that was eventually the agreement that was formed. So we have to work with the communities out there as you develop a project, and so we'll be doing that. We'll be trying to work with them.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Let me, Mr. Kawasaki, or Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks. Just a really quick question on Senator Keel's question, dealing with tech and the differences between that Red Dog Mine proposal with little bubbles and then this one. I've got I guess some questions. You mentioned that Tech had already gone through the EIS and permitting process themselves, and really at the point where they just needed a road, that's when ADA came in. Is that the big difference between this project and that project?
I think what we're doing here is we're building the infrastructure for exploration and then development, whereas that infrastructure was designed to help a mine that was more like permitted. So if you took the example of Donlin right now, if we were going to build infrastructure for Donlin, that would be a little bit more like Red Dog, because you've already got some of the permitting done for Donlin. That doesn't mean that mine's going to open. It just means you're somewhat farther along the way. On the other hand, when you're building an industrial access road like this, and there's interest in exploration, we would charge companies to come in and use that facility for exploration. And I think there's a lot of interest in the region, so that I actually think the risk allocation of this project is less.
Mr. San Juan.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, a follow-up to what Mark Davis mentioned is also part of our road is kind of, as Senator Raibo mentioned, is to unlock the resources in there. And so we're not really looking at providing access to just one particular mine, as in the case of Red Dog. What we're looking at is unlocking the whole district. We would like to actually have several mines for this project, and not specifically just one. Obviously, we have one mine right now that's further ahead than most, but we're looking at a project and access to a mining district, not simply one road to a specific mine as compared to the Red Dog.
So through the chair, and you mentioned Sumitomo, also Pogo in our neck of the woods in the interior. Were they permitted prior to building their own road?
I don't know the answer to that. I just know that the change in the usage from talking with DNR, and we explore that to see, you know, how you might interface with communities as you go through the process. So I didn't look at that. I don't know the answer.
Okay. And then there's $17 million that's been expended by ADA so far, plus the money that was from DOT when it was a DOT capital project in the 2013. Don't you think that there is risk that we are assuming, and has there been any question with the ADA board that risk is too high? It seems more like you'd want prospectors to go out and say, I found something, I can't get to it, and then come to you as the ADA bond bank.
Senator Kennedy, the chair. We're looking at the development of the resources, and we're monitoring that. If you want to hear, the Trilogy is here to answer a lot more specificity. But they are finding a good commodity out there. They've found more minerals. The mineralization is actually improving. They've got a PEA. They're moving toward feasibility, which is a fairly advanced stage of development. And then bornite actually was mined at one time. So we actually know it's a real resource. It's not a resource that's kind of needs to be developed. Its problem is they mined it, as I understand it, they ran into artesian wells underground and it flooded. But today they think they can manage that and then open that mine. So it looks to us like there's a very good chance that if we complete the IS, then we'll be able to enter into the agreements. But I said, we're not just going to build the road and hope somebody shows up. We're going to get the permits and then approach the markets for financing, then approach the people who would use it, enter into those agreements, and then once you have all that put together, then you actually commence construction.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Sir Bishop.
Thank you. So, Mr. Davis, it's a real pleasure to hear you speak, and I always enjoy your testimony. So let me sum this up real quick. You're not going to spend $40 billion for a $20 billion project to build a road.
No, Senator, not.
Okay. The second comment, if I can follow up. It's just a comment, it's not a question. You know, Fort Knox and Fairbanks, I doubt if that project would have been built if there hadn't have been a road that you could drive from asphalt to bedrock. infrastructure is the key to unlocking our resources in this state. And I just go back to the 7I and 7J royalties that's been paid out to all of the regional corporations and look at that, if you didn't zero in on that, and that's shared with all 13 regional corps just off of one project. And we were able to capitalize on that and make that grow. That's better for all of our regional corporations and our shareholders in the state, and I think that's a good thing. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I just want to recognize Tom Bhutan, a new executive director for the for ADA, is in the audience. Thank you, sir, for joining us this afternoon. And as a former forester, I'll let you know that we're going to have a great program on Friday on forestry here in this very same meeting. Are there other questions for the presenters? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, just a couple other questions on the corridor and alternative routes. I guess I'll scrap that question. On maintenance, if the road were to be built, would the state assume maintenance, or would that be done on an agreement between the developers, the other parts and pieces in the little circle graph?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, that's an excellent question, because that's part of our model. First of all, we're not trying to use any state funds or any further funds. So this road would probably be owned by a limited liability company or a corporation in which there'd be multiple investors. And then you set in that ordinance for that structure, you would set up a reserve account in the bonding to cover maintenance, and then you'd recoup that cost by setting the tolls, and you'd have an escalator cost. If you had a more maintenance than anticipated, then the toll would go up to take that backlog. So it will not be maintained by the state. It would be maintained by the owner of the road, and the owner of the road will probably be an LLC.
And then just on that, so the state wouldn't be a party to the ownership of the road itself, so the road would not be a public road or a public access easement?
There's two responses to that. First, the way it's designed now, it would be a limited road, and it wouldn't be a public road in the sense that it's built with public funds or federal highway dollars or DOT dollars. The right-of-ways haven't been negotiated. We have to see what type of right-of-way BLM is willing to give us. That's a federal decision. And they have a whole types they can give you. Then, if we get the EIS and we decide to go forward, we'll have to negotiate with the other landowners. That will be include DNR. It could be Doyon. It could certainly be Nana, and ask them for permission to cross their land, and then they landowners often put restrictions on easements across land, and I assume there will be easements restrictions on this, and then there'll be other restrictions due to environmental mitigation. So this will not be a road that would just be open, quote, to the public, but there could be other uses of the road beyond just the mines. And the kind of the maturation process of the DMTS may serve as an example. So originally, you know, they just ran the ore down and they were doing good. And the local people up there asked Tech if they could bring in some supplies for them. And they do that now. And we actually constructed some lay-bys. And so they bring like fuel in. And then they put them on the side of the road in a safe area, and then they can come get them in the summer or with snow machines in the winter. So as the road goes along, there may be accommodations, which are hard to foresee. But if it was owned by an LLC, anyone could petition that LLC for a use, and then that governing body would look at it.
Ms. Davis, other questions? Senator Rainbow.
Okay, so mine actually is a follow-up to one that I had earlier, and so I'm going to preface it again just so people can follow. But basically, ANILCA established the 10 federal parks, preserves, monuments, et cetera, by guaranteeing certain rights. One of the rights was ensuring access to and from resource development areas within the state. What my question was earlier, and it's going to be the same, but I felt like it wasn't answered, was do you believe that you'll be able to overcome the resistance to this, and because it says, in balancing interests, Congress recognized the mineral potential of the specific needs to access the Ambler Mining District to ensure the economic and social needs of the people of Alaska are met. And then it goes in, you know, the specific section of 2014. My question, once again, do you believe that you can overcome the resistance or the objectives, because this is pretty powerful stuff in this federal law?
The Honorable, through the chair. Yeah, the congressional intent is clear that it was meant for the state to be able to cross some of the conservation units, and unfortunately that hasn't occurred yet. I hope it does. With regard to this particular project, as Mr. San Juan pointed out, there is been some opposition. It's in the scoping document, which is the public document. It's hosted on the BLM site. And we've read every comment, and part of the IS will be to develop a route that is much compatible with all those comments, and that's why we've already changed the route once. You know, because we had the folks in Bethel didn't want the trucks driving right through town, which was the original route the DOT had. That's probably understandable that they didn't want trucks driving right through town. So we'll have to work through each one of those comments in the draft EIS.
And can I just wrap up?
Follow up?
Okay, so I've built with trails. I've done with access plans, management plans, and all that. I'm not into the public comments. I'm not asking about local hire, even though I know that all that stuff is important. My question is, this is very, very powerful, this ANILCA, and it just seems so much more powerful than a public comment, you know, because you can get thousands of public comments, because I know I went through it for 5 years. I dealt with that, the EIS, the NEPA, the access plan, the management plan, the trails plan. I did all that. But my question is, this ANILCA is so powerful, and it just seems to me that their intent should be able to overcome all this. And I'm hoping for an affirmative, you know, yes, that we'll be able to, that you guys are going to be able to work through that, because it's already law.
Well, Senator, I really can't comment on the state position on ANILCA, but I personally would agree with you that it had certain provisions in there. It was a compromise. It worked out like a lot of compromises in legislation, for the state to have certain rights, the federal government to have certain rights, and it preserves certain subsistence rights. If you read the Sturgeon decision, the first one, it went through that at great length, and I thought it was an interesting decision. It says Alaska is different, and if you read it, it's an interesting statement by the U.S. Supreme Court. It finally admits it, that we're different. One of the reasons we were interested in this project was to take the right granted in ANILCA to cross the boot and see if we could make it work. I mean, that was an idea.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Just one last question on the permitting process and the timeline, whether there's enough state staff at Fish and Game, DEC, and DNR to be able to properly permit this thing. And then secondly, if this is permitting just the road itself, what happens if the road gets permitted but a mine at the end of the road does not get permitted?
Senator Kalasek, through the chair. The first one, I can't really comment on the levels of each agency, but I can tell you we work with OPUMP, the permitting unit within DNR. We've hired them on almost every project we do. They are hired on this project. And so far, they've been giving us tremendous service on issues of working with the BLM or permitting issues on the state side. And so I want to say that the state employees we have that we've worked with have been excellent, and I hope they have the resources to do it. And then what happens if a mine doesn't open? Well, we would have agreements, as I said, and those agreements would have what lawyers call sideboards. And one sideboard would be, let's say the mines agreed to use the road and we floated the bonds and they're going to pay and they're going to open. They don't open. There's going to have to be some mechanism in those legal documents to handle that contingency. And we haven't drafted them yet, but we will work on that. We don't enter into any kind of agreements where if something doesn't work, we don't get paid.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Proceeding down that same path, you opened up with, unlike DOT, we don't have eminent domain, and we talked a little bit about this process, and then after the permits are generally in hand, you got to work with some of the private landowners. So if you have to change routes pretty significantly to accommodate private landowners, do you have the funding in hand to go through that additional process?
Senator Keel, good question. So ADA has a if we did do we need that, I hope we don't. I don't think we will, but that's a good question. You can always run into any kind of contingency on a project. ADA has a resolution process called G1118 that the board passed, and it allows under the new statutes, which the legislature passed, which we appreciate, for ADA to use its own funds for permitting as part of a project. Before, there was a legal issue about whether we could permit or we had to actually build hard assets, and that was clarified. So now if we need more money for permitting, if we need to change the route, if we need to do an EA or an environmental assessment, which is a part of an EIS when you're modifying it, ADA, if the board agreed, could spend its own funds.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Just one quick follow-up. How long is the record of decision good for?
That is, Senator Bishop, that's a very good question through the chair. That's a matter of really Ninth Circuit law. There is nothing in NEPA that says how long a record of decision is good for. My reading of the cases, and again, I'm not practicing law. You'd have to ask the Attorney General for any definitive legal opinion. But looking at some cases, they've tended to say 5 to 6 years. After that, they've tended to say, well, we need to dust this off and look at it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just trying to get a little better understanding. You put 4 red stars and 18 yellow stars on here, and I just want to make sure we don't get stars in our eyes. As Senator Bishop, you know, talked about access to the resource, once you hit the Hall Road, it's still a ways to the Skagway Ore Terminal, which I trust will be the plan, right? That one's in my district. So I'm just thinking about the cost to a mine developer. And you've often used the plural, talking about who's going to pay off what ADA borrows for the road. So, I mean, how do you envision that working? Do you build it once do you need to only have one mine, and are you going to take a risk on the second one opening? Do you need 2 mines and make sure you've got enough payments to pay off the road without making the mine uneconomic? Does the first guy do it and everybody else is gravy? How's that work?
Well, Senator Keel, Chair, that's a good question. So, internally, we develop econometric models that are computer-driven, and our analysis shows that one mine would be sufficient to pay the tolls for the first 2 phases. But that wouldn't be the optimal model. The optimal model would be more than one mine. And so that would be a decision for the board. When you say, well, we only got one mine now, do you really want to go forward with this thing? And there's risk, right? It's payable, but there's risk. Or better yet, we have 2 mines, there's much less risk. Again, those are decisions being made by the ADA board, and that's one of the reasons it's good to use ADA. You don't have a political process, you don't have an agency making the decision, you've got 7 board members who are tasked with making that decision. Is it good or bad?
One mine pays the first 2. Okay.
Well,
at this opportunity, I want to thank Mr. Davis and Mr. San Juan for an extraordinarily good presentation, for making the trip here to Juneau to present to the our Resources Committee and the community. It's fascinating. There were several questions that popped up on the regarding the development costs and so forth. And I would note that Rick Van Nieuwenhuis, the project developer with CEO of Trilogy, is here in the audience. If the committee wants to hear from Mr. Van Nieuwenhuis for a few minutes. That would be okay. Great.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Davis and Mr. San Juan. Excellent presentation.
You got it.
Yeah, good. Come on forward. Give your name for the record, and we've been talking about something that's probably near and dear to your heart, and I thought it might be a good opportunity to maybe brief the committee on for a few minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Birch. Pleasure to be back here. This is near and dear to my heart. I worked in this district as my first job as a young geologist in the late 1970s, so I spent 4 years up here. So it's great to see something that Senator Stevens put forward as a hardwired right by the state to traverse federal lands to access this incredible mining district. We've spent $120 million since 2004 when we first got involved as precursor to Trilogy. There's a bit of history there, but I won't go into that. But that's how much we've expended to date. We have formed a partnership with a major mining company called South 32. They are an Australian company. We seem to see the Australians moving into Alaska in a significant way in terms of investment, in particularly in mining. They are a $17 billion market cap company. They generate about $1.5 billion of free cash flow a year from their mining operations, which are located mostly in the southern hemisphere, which hence their name, South 32. Perth is located at the southern 32nd parallel. So we made them T-shirts acknowledging that they're working north of 67. So,
Mr. Van Nuenen, could you put your name and affiliation on the record? Just for
My name is Rick Van Nuenheisen. I'm the president and CEO of Trilogy Metals. My apologies. We have expended a significant amount of dollars. We have a major company as a partner in this venture. They are looking at the permission to build a road, an access road, because, you know, effectively without the road, you have no mine at the other end of it. So it is a bit of a chicken and an egg. I appreciate some of the questions that I heard from Senator Kawasaki. Do you permit the mine first? Do you permit the road? Frankly, we've had lengthy discussions with the Corps of Engineers, they wouldn't permit the mine before you permit a road, because you have no way to connect to anything. This mine is producing metal concentrates of copper, zinc, and lead, and that lead contains the gold and the silver. We've looked at airships. We've looked at 747-400 long haulers. They don't work. It's too expensive. We have investigated alternatives to roads. Maybe someday they'll make an airship big enough that the economics might work, but that's certainly not any time soon. Our plan is to haul these concentrates in metal boxes that look like about a half of a sea can, in terms of their size, but they're about half the height. They have locking lids, so you don't lose any concentrates to the environment. That saves us money, but it also saves the environment, so we think that's a good approach. They would be hauled down to Fairbanks to link up to the Alaska Railroad. They're transferred with a forklift, so they're very simple to move around. They'd be transferred to the Alaska Railroad, then hauled down to Senator Kale, down to the Port of Anchorage.
We'll talk.
Which is set up with overhead cranes that can easily move these concentrate containers and load them directly into the ship hold, so that, again, you don't lose any metal dust to the environment. So jobs at the mine, jobs at the security gate to ensure that this remains a limited private access road, and jobs in Fairbanks and jobs in Anchorage.
Great. Any questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you, and sorry we didn't get to chat about this earlier today. Has there been any thought? So, where does the concentrate go next after that point?
Most likely to Asia. The world has a lot of smelters, probably too many smelters, frankly. There are no dedicated smelters in the U.S., or I should say, there are no smelters that are not dedicated in the U.S. There's a smelter in Arizona, there's several smelters in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, but they're all dedicated to their specific operations. The ones that would be open to receive concentrates would most likely be in Japan, Korea, and China. And they're relatively close to the Alaska market.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one.
Oh. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think the last 10K I looked at said you don't have proven or probable reserves yet. Do you have a sense of – do you have an indicated reserve that you're able to share with us?
So just to be clear, we have – there's resources and there's reserves. So So we've completed a pre-feasibility study, and therefore we have probable reserves. And that's 43 million tons of roughly 5% copper equivalent. We are completing in the process of completing a feasibility now. We'll have a summer field program. We're spending $18 million this year. Not all of it on Arctic. We're doing a few other things as well in the district. And so at the end of that, we'll have proven and probable reserves at Arctic. Bornite is a few years behind, probably 4 or 5 years behind Arctic in terms of its development cycle. And we have resources there, indicated and inferred resources, which we'll be updating at the end of the month here.
Thanks. That helps. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Okay. Well, in closing, I wanted to thank you, Mr. Van Nieuwenhuyst, for making yourself available here on virtually no notice, and also thank Mr. Davis and Mr. San Juan for an outstanding presentation on the entire Ambler Access Road project. I would note that the next committee meeting will be held 3:30 Friday, February 15th, when we will hear an update on the Alaska timber industry. So with that, we're adjourned at about